ready to start 2 Kings chapter 8. We did the first 7 chapters the last time that we were together. Beginning with in chapter 8, verse number 11. To get the story. The king was sick, and a messenger was sent to ask if that king was going to recover. He asked Elisha the prophet, "Is the king going to recover from this disease?" Elisha said to him, "Go say unto him, you may certainly recover. However, or howbeit, the Lord has shown me that he shall surely die." And he, Elisha, settled his countenance steadfastly until he, that the messenger, was ashamed, and the man of God wept. There are a couple of things in this short section that are important, but the key here is those last few words, "the man of God wept." In our society, of course, they make a big show out of men being strong, men being tough, men never crying. But the man of God is willing to weep. He's willing to cry when the timing is appropriate. The messenger had to yell with his name, asked, "Why weepest, my lord?" And Elisha answered him, "Because I know the evil that you will do to the children of Israel." That's one of the causes for a man of God to weep, when he sees the evil that's being done to the people of God. God's people all the time are in various places in the world are suffering from some sort of evil. In one place, it may be one type of evil, in another place, another type of evil, but still, throughout the world, God's people suffer as a result of evil. And there's no shame in crying. It's interesting also, this phrase that he says, "Go and say unto him, you may certainly recover, but the Lord has shown me that he shall surely die." Now, at first glance, that might seem contradictory. He shall recover, but he shall surely die. Well, there are certainly a lot of different ways that the prophet could mean that. Obviously, all of us are going to surely die, regardless of whether we recover from a particular illness or not. And I don't think that's what he means here. Notice the use of the word "may." He tells the king, "You may recover, certainly." In other words, the illness is not what's going to cause his death. He had the ability to recover from that illness. But despite that ability to recover from the illness, he was going to die. And he didn't just mean he's going to die like all of us are going to die. He meant he's going to die before he gets well. And the reasoning for that, we look on down, we see that Elisha and Haziel continue this conversation after he tells all the horrible things that Haziel is going to do to the children of Israel. Verse 12, then Haziel says, "I'm just a servant. How am I going to do all these things?" And Elisha says, "You're going to be king of Syria." And the reason for that we see in the next couple of verses. Elisha left, and the servant, the messenger left and went back home. Verse 15 says, "It came to pass on the morrow," the very next day. So Elisha was able to know what was going to happen. That was one of the things of a prophet. He could know the future. Even though he knew the king might, he can certainly heal up from this sickness. He can certainly overcome this disease that he's struck with. He goes on to explain then what happened. The next day, Haziel took a thick cloth and dipped it in water and spread it on the king's face so that he died, and Haziel reigned in his place. So possibly the man could have recovered. When Haziel found out that the man could have recovered, he didn't like that idea, so he killed him. And so Elisha's words certainly came true, that he could have survived. And Hadad, the king, certainly could have gotten better, but instead Haziel killed him. Then we see of a new king, Jehoshaphat, who was the king of Judah. He was king for a good many years. Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, began to be the king. He began to reign in his father's place. And it says he was 32 years old. Verse 18 says he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, as did the house of Ahab. For the daughter of Ahab was his wife, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord. Young people should always take that to heart. The kind of person you marry will have a great impact on the kind of person you become in many cases. In many, many cases, the kind of person that you marry will determine what kind of person you become. A person who is sinful and wicked will certainly corrupt, to some degree, a person who is righteous. We don't know what kind of man, what kind of king this young man might have been. But we do know that because he married Ahab's daughter, we know what a wicked man Ahab was, and we also know that a lot of Ahab's wickedness came from the woman he married, Jezebel. In fact, it's quite possible and quite likely that she was even more wicked than he was. And yet, this man, who was to be the king of Judah, went and married Ahab's daughter. Not a lot of wisdom in that choice for a wife. But he did evil in the sight of the Lord. It says, if you go through the books of 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, and just underline every time it says he did evil in the sight of the Lord, so many of the kings, every single one of the kings of Israel, the northern tribes, they were wicked. And that's why it says here that he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. The kings of Israel had all been wicked. It said he followed in their footsteps. Jehoshaphat was not a particularly spectacular king, but he wasn't a bad king either. And this man had the potential to be better than his father, I'm sure. You know, all of us, we look at what our parents did, and we want to do better than they did. Parents always look at their children, and they want their children to do better than they did. We all have that feeling. And I'm sure Jehoshaphat would have wanted his son to be a better king, even than he was. And he could have been, if he had followed the right path, but he didn't follow that path. Then down in 27, we see another king. Verse 26 says, 2 and 20 years old was Ahaziah when he began to reign, and he reigned 1 year in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Athaliah, the daughter of Omri, king of Israel. And he walked in the way of the house of Ahab, and did evil in the sight of the Lord, as did the house of Ahab, for he was the son-in-law of the house of Ahab. So here, another king who does wickedly from being involved in this relationship with this house of Ahab. They used to have a saying, I suppose some people still use it, it's hard to soar with the eagles, hang out with chickens. It's hard to rise in the morning if you're up all night with the owls. There are a lot of sayings along those lines of hard. It's hard to be clean if you're rolling around with the pigs. And those things rub off more a lot of times than we'd like to admit they do. But they will rub off on us if we hang out with those kinds of people. They will bring us down eventually. Chapter 9 then. Jehu is told that he is going to be the king because of what a wicked man Ahab was. The prophet tells him, thou shalt smite, verse 7 of chapter 9, thou shalt smite the house of Ahab thy master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, and the blood of all the servants of the Lord at the hand of Jezebel. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish, and I will cut off from Ahab him that who was going to be the man who was going to do it. And certainly he carries that out. Now you would think that the person who destroyed Ahab and his whole family would be a righteous man. But it doesn't turn out that way. You think, if somebody is so wicked they need to be destroyed, God's surely going to find a righteous person to do it. Well, sometimes God uses even the sinful people to do his bidding. Did you know that some of the wicked kings are even referred to as being God's servants? Nebuchadnezzar, for example, who built the golden idol that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to bow down and worship before. He's spoken of as being a minister of God, a servant of God. Because he did God's bidding in one area. Not that he was a good man, not that he was righteous, not that he was one of God's people, but he was a servant of God. He was used by God in that one area. In chapter 10 and verse 18, we see Jehu, though, he's a crafty fellow. God has told him to destroy Ahab and his family. He's supposed to destroy all of the idolatry and the worship of Baal. Notice what he does. Verse 18 says, "And Jehu gathered all the people together and said unto them, Ahab served Baal a little, but Jehu shall serve him much." And it was by means of that trickery that he was able then to get all of the priests of Baal to come out. And he had his followers then waiting. And when they all came together with a big sacrifice to worship Baal, Jehu had his servants come in and destroy Baal. Verse 28 says, "Thus Jehu destroyed Baal out of Israel." But that wasn't good enough. Certainly good to leave one idol, but leaving one isn't good enough. We've got to leave them all. We've got to depart from all the idols to serve God only. See, verse 29 tells us, "Howbeit from the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin, Jehu departed not from after them the golden calves that were in Bethel and in Dan." So Jehu kept worshiping idols, he just didn't worship Baal. So we might say, well, he wasn't as bad as Ahab. But at the same time, any idolatry is wickedness in the sight of the Lord. Chapter 11, verse 1. "When Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she arose and destroyed all the seed royal." She killed off all of the offspring that could have had a chance for the throne. And she decided that she was going to reign over the land. Verse 3, there was one, Joash, who was kept by and hidden. Says he was with her hid in the house of the Lord 6 years with a servant who had taken him away when she found out that Athaliah was killing everyone. It says that Athaliah did reign over the land. The only time in all of the history of the kings over Israel that a woman reigned. She didn't reign for too long, but she did reign for a while as the queen over the land until finally her wickedness came back to haunt her and she was killed and destroyed. And Joash then began to be the king. Verse 21 of chapter 11 says, 7 years old was Jehoash when he began to reign. Just 7 years old. Pretty young. He's the youngest of the kings. Quinn, how old are you? You're 8. How would you like to be king of the whole country? It'd be pretty tough, though. Now, you gotta remember, there's a lot of responsibility. That's a tough task, being the king. Can you imagine? 7 years old, he became the king. Well, of course, he had some helpers that watched over him. I want us to notice then in chapter 12, verse number 2, Joash, or Jehoash, did that which was right in the sight of the Lord all his days wherein Jehoiada the priest instructed him. Now that's very important. You might want to mark there a cross-reference to another place, and that is 2 Chronicles 2 Chronicles chapter 24 and verse number 17, we see something interesting occurring in the life of Joash. Remember that 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles kind of echo each other a little bit. 2 Chronicles 24, verse number 17. Notice what it says. Now after the death of Jehoiada. Jehoiada had taken Joash as a 7-year-old and had taught him how to be a good king. And he was a good king for all those years while Jehoiada was alive. But Jehoiada died. And after the death of Jehoiada came the princes of Judah and made obeisance to the king. In other words, they paid their homage. They basically came and bowed before the king. But there was more than just bowing. They were also pleading with him to do some things. It said, then the king hearkened unto them, and they left the house of the Lord God of their fathers, and served groves and idols, and wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for this their trespass. You see how a man can change. Joash, who was a good man, was being instructed by Jehoiada from the time he was 7 years old. And he worked hard to repair the temple in chapter 12 of 2 Kings. It tells us that. But that one phrase, Joash did that which was right in the sight of the Lord all his days. Well, if it stopped right there, wouldn't that be great? But it didn't stop there. It said all his days that Jehoiada the priest instructed him. After Jehoiada the priest died and was no longer able to instruct him, he left and departed from doing those things which were right. And listened to the people. And this shows us how important it is for a leader to lead and not to follow. As long as Jehoiada was, in essence, the king, because he was instructing Joash how to do it, he was the one actually doing the leading. Joash was following. Jehoiada made one mistake. He didn't teach Joash how to be a leader. Instead, he instructed Joash and had Joash following him and doing those things. But then when he was gone, Joash, who was a follower, needed somebody else to follow. And so he began following the people. Well, not a good thing for the king to follow the people. The king is supposed to be leading the people. The same thing holds true in the church today. The elders, teachers, the older Christians, the more mature, they're supposed to lead. They're supposed to be the example. They're supposed to show how things are to be done. But if instead they're just following with the whims of the rest of the congregation will be unstable. We see that throughout the religious world today, that there are many who aren't leaders, they're followers. If they want to know whether to have a piano, they don't go to God's Word to find out what's right or what's wrong. They just take a vote. Well, shall we have one or not? And then they go with whatever the majority is. They just follow along with whatever's popular at the time. Is it right to do this or that? They don't care what God says. They just follow the people. And that's what happened with Joash. He was doing the right things for a while, but then he got sidetracked and started listening to the people rather than to God. Chapter 13, then, we see again. Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, begins to reign over Israel. In verse 2 it says, he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord and followed the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat. He departed not therefrom. So you see how easy it is once a sin has started, how easy it is to just follow along in that same path for generation after generation. We see that with all of these kings of Israel. Even though some of them, you know, fought back a little way to try to get rid of some of the bad things, but that original sin that Jeroboam did of building those calves for the people to worship, not a single king of Israel ever went back and made that right. Not a single one. We see it if we look at church history. We see how evil creeps up and gains a little ground, and then that's thought to be the place to start. And then evil will creep up a little further. We see it in the apostasy of the church from the first century, from what it was supposed to be, what the apostles preached and taught that it was supposed to be. And yet, along the way, down through the years, second century after Christ, the third century after Christ, and on, little by little, they changed things. Changed a little here and a little there. So much so that probably in one generation it wasn't even all that noticeable to the people. But so much so that by about 500 years after Christ, instead of having individual congregations who were led by groups of men referred to as elders or bishops or pastors as the New Testament teaches, they had one man over each church who was called a pastor or a bishop. And then over that, over several churches in the area, they had one man who was like an archbishop or something of that nature, who was over several. That's exactly backwards. There's supposed to be several men over one congregation. Instead, they've got one man over several congregations. That's not the way the Bible describes it. But see, once it got to that point, then everybody just thought that was normal. Thought that was the way it was supposed to be, and they didn't go back. And we see then with the Reformation movement, Martin Luther complaining about some of the things in the Catholic Church and saying, you know, we need to change some things. There's some things here that aren't right. And so he started trying to change a few things. But he never did go all the way back to the Bible. He started from that same foundational base of error. And he just tried to reform a few of the things that he thought weren't right. And on through, men have always done that. They just change the things that they don't like or the things that they don't think are right. Instead of going back to God's Word as we should and starting afresh and building the church from its foundation, from Christ, and building it all the way up. Then we see that verse 11, again, speaking of this time Jehoash, who was Jehoahaz's son. Well, I tell you, these names get confusing, don't they? So many of them are so similar. But this was his son became the king, and the same thing is said. He did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. He departed not from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Then we see in verses 18 and 19. Elisha is sick and about to die. And the king comes to him. Joash, the king of Israel, comes to him. And he says, that Elisha, that is, says to him, take the arrows. And so the king took them. And he said to the king, smite upon the ground, or hit on the ground with those arrows. And he hit three times. He smote thrice, the King James says, and stayed or stopped. So he just whack, 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 and he stopped. Now you notice, Elisha didn't tell him how many times to hit. See, it's an interesting thing. When God tells you to do something, you better keep doing it until he tells you to stop. That's the problem a lot of people in the religious world today have. Oh, they know that back in the first century they sang a cappella without instruments like we sing. They know that God told the people back then to do it. But well, times have changed and it's different now. No, it's not. When God tells you to do something, you better do it until he tells you to stop. And that's the problem this king had. Elisha, giving him God's message, told him, hit the ground with the arrows. And so he hits it three times, and then he stops. Says the man of God was angry with him. And he said, you should have hit it five or six times. Then hast thou smitten Syria till thou hast consumed it. Whereas now thou shalt smite Syria but thrice or three times. Is that how many times you hit with you? See, if the man had just kept hitting, Elisha would finally say, okay, that's enough. You've hit enough. And then he would have been glad, and he would have said, you know, you're going to destroy Syria just as much as you have struck with these arrows. But instead, the man stopped. And as a result of that, they weren't able to destroy Syria, but only to fight for a short time. Chapter 14, and we'll stop with this one. Chapter 14 talks about Amaziah, king of Judah. Verse 3, it says, "And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, yet not like David his father. He did according to the things as Joash his father did. Albeit the high places were not taken away, and yet, as yet, the people did sacrifice and burnt incense on the high places." So he didn't worship any idols, but he didn't do like David did. David is, throughout the books of Kings, 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles, David is the example. He is the best king. And everyone that comes after him is compared to him. Now, that's the way it is sometimes, isn't it? Whoever was first, is, everybody gets compared to that one. I know some of you are younger brothers and sisters, so you know how that works. Doesn't matter who you are, when you go to school, oh, well, you're so-and-so's little brother or little sister or something like that. And the teacher always expects either really good things or really bad things, depending on what that older child was like. And you're not thought of, in many cases, as an individual. You're always compared back to somebody else. If nothing else, you're compared to your parents. Or, in Sanders' case, he gets compared even back to his grandpa. My parents still call me Adrian. There's Adrian and Don, and there's little Larry. His name's not even, Larry's nowhere in his name, but that's little Larry. That's my dad, Larry. And so, you know, you get compared, you're always going to be compared to somebody. And this, David was the one to whom all the other kings were compared. Because David was the man after God's own heart. He was God's favorite king. He was the one who, as much as he could, did everything that God wanted him to do. He even offered and wanted to do more than God let him do. He wanted to build the temple and God wouldn't let him. So, this was the man that was set up as the example for the other kings that be like him. And so he did, this king though, Amaziah, did good, he did right, but not like David. He didn't do as right as David did. He did like Joash did, and we saw how Joash was a good king. But then, at the end, he made some mistakes and did follow the wrong crowd and did the wrong things. We'll start with chapter 15 next time. If you're here tonight, perhaps you've been following the wrong thing, the wrong crowd, the wrong person. You may need to correct that tonight and start following Jesus. Start doing those things which are right in God's sight, instead of doing those things that would be considered evil in God's sight, like some of these wicked kings. If you're here and you have a need to respond to the invitation in any way, I ask that you would do so as we stand.